Why are we here? What's life all about? Is God really real? Or is there some doubt? Well, tonight we're going to sort it all out. For tonight, it's the meaning of life.
You've joined the Betamax Video Club, rewinding back to our favourite films of the 1980s. My name's Richard Nelson, and tonight I've rented Monty Python's The Meaning of Life. Watching with me is Sophie Davis, who on Twitter is It's Sophie Davis. Hi Sophie, how are you?
Hello, I'm good, thanks. How are you?
I'm good. Thank you for bringing your Betamax copy of The Meaning of Life, which is mentioned in the film. What's so special about this movie for you?
Well, I have memories of my parents showing me The Galaxy Song when I was really young, like far too young to watch the actual film itself. So they just used to show me this one song all the time, just completely out of context. And then eventually, when I was about 13 or 14, I think, my dad started watching Python films with me. And that's when I finally got to find out the context for this weird song that apparently I was going around the house singing when I was about 10, with no idea what any of the words meant.
Were you or were your parents sort of Python fans in general?
Yeah, my dad definitely. My mum likes some of it. But yeah, my dad, it's almost like he was sort of waiting for me to reach a suitable age to start showing me Python. And I think I watched Blackadder when I was a bit younger. That's a bit more appropriate. But yeah, the films and then the TV series, I think he introduced me to a little bit after that.
Yeah, you always got to blame your parents for these things, haven't you?
Yeah, I find most of the time when people my sort of age are into that sort of slightly older comedy, it's usually because we've got a parent, usually it's a dad, who's just sort of forced it upon us at a young age.
Yeah, I think I never really had that. I mean, I was aware of who Monty Python were, and I think, you know, until I was a bit older, I'd always just assumed they were a group of people who made films. My cousin had The Life of Brian on Betamax, which we watched several times, and obviously was one of those, being quite young, I didn't get many of the jokes, but and I remember this one as well. I can't remember if I saw it on the telly or on video, and you know, certain bits of it, like the Mr. Creosote that we'll come to later, and the head teacher and the sex education lesson, they seem to be ones that stuck in my head for some reason. And watching it again now for the first time in at least a couple of years, it's just so strange when you look at it as in comparison to The Holy Grail and The Life of Brian. And this is essentially a selection of sketches that have, I suppose, an ulterior motive. But I mean, watching it again, how did you find it compared to some of the other things?
Yeah, it's got a little bit of a reputation, doesn't it, for being the sort of least good Python film. I looked at some reviews the other day from the time, and they were a bit mixed. And I think over the years, the Pythons themselves have been a little bit critical of the film to sort of varying degrees. I think John Cleese basically says it's a load of crap, which doesn't really surprise me because he would say that sort of thing. But I mean, at the time when I first watched it, I wasn't aware of any of that. And it was never really my favourite of the films, but I didn't really think it was, you know, a lesser film than the others. Like you say, it's less of a, there's less of a narrative in it. If you look at Holy Grail and Life of Brian, they are kind of sketch films as well, but they do have more of a central character and then a narrative running throughout it, like with, you know, following Brian or following King Arthur. But there are essentially sketches in those films, meeting all of these different characters and different situations. But then Meaning of Life, a lot of people seem to think it was a little bit of a regression for them because it was more like the TV show where it's a load of sketches and they are sort of linked by a theme, but they're not really.
I mean, coming to it, I suppose it's difficult if you're any artist of any repute, if you produce a body of work over, you know, a number of years in the way that they have, and, you know, TV, radio, and then going into the movies, then I guess anything that's considered a reduction or a regression is going to be looked on in a different way. And I guess this is bad because, you know, you watch this independently, it's funny, it's, they've obviously put a lot of money into it at various stages, there's a lot of effort, and, you know, part of you will always think, oh, it's not Life of Brian, which is sad in a way.
Yeah, apparently after Life of Brian came out, their business manager basically told them, if you make another film pretty much straight away, you'll never have to work again. And Terry Jones says in the DVD extras that John Cleese's face lit up at that moment. So they set about making this new film pretty soon after Life of Brian. And apparently, yeah, they couldn't really think of a theme for it. They were just writing sketches independent from each other. And they went to Jamaica at one point to write it, as you do, because that was apparently a thing in the 80s. You could just nip off, you know, a load of comedy writers to go and write in Jamaica for a while. And even then, apparently, they were struggling. John Cleese suggested at one point that they should just scrap it all together and not do a fourth film. Sorry, I say fourth, I'm including And Now for Something Completely Different as a film. And I think there's a bit of contention around who actually came up with the meaning of life as a concept. But they all seem to kind of agree that Terry Jones started putting some of their sketches in an order and realised, oh, OK, there's some about childhood, there's some about adulthood, there's some about death. Oh, it could be someone's life story. And then apparently one of the others said, oh, well, it could be anyone's life story. It could be the meaning of life. So, you know, that wasn't the theme from the start. It was more like they wrote some sketches and then they thought, these could link together in this vague way.
And when you think about this movie, not many people or creatives would consider opening a large movie production with a smaller movie production taking up the first, 15 minutes or so. The short feature presentation that isn't actually very short.
Yeah, it's mad, isn't it? Well, apparently, to begin with, it was supposed to be a little short animated section within the actual film. And Terry Gilliam at this point in his career was quite sort of into doing live action stuff because he'd done Time Bandits and other stuff. So he asked if he could do a live action sketch instead of an animated sketch, and they said yes, and then sort of lived to regret it because he went really overboard. He apparently said, nobody told me to stop, which is his excuse for this, really. You know, he made it, presented it to them, and they were like, what have you done? You've gone massively over budget. And it's 15 minutes long when it was supposed to be only a few minutes long. And they tried to fit it into the film, but it just wasn't working, obviously, because it's completely sort of stylistically different from the rest of it. And then, yeah, they came up with this solution to put it before the main film as, what is it, a short presentation before it to try and fit it in somewhere.
It's funny watching it now, and I'd forgotten parts of it, but essentially, and this is the Crimson Permanent Assurance, essentially a load of, I don't know, it sort of reminded me of Glengarry Glen Ross for initially, is a kind of a group of, to be honest, very old men working in an office. And as their new, younger paymasters come in, they're being treated like slaves on, I mean, look, you know, I hope this isn't inappropriate, but like something out of Amistad or something like that, rowing away. And it's almost a bit like the scenes from Eric the Viking that we did in another episode. Watching, and again, you know that this is a Monty Python film, it's going to get weird. And no, I imagine sitting in a movie theater or cinema and watching this, not knowing what's going to happen when a load of old men take over a building which is covered in scaffolding so it can turn into a ship and sail off. It's if you haven't seen it, it's exactly as ludicrous as it sounds.
Yeah, I remember I always used to skip this when I was younger. I think I watched it the first time, and I mean, for me, it's not the sort of thing that I want to watch over and over again like I do with the, you know, the sketches in the film. It is a very visual thing. And I think, yeah, visually it is great. I really like how they make weapons out of all the things in the office. And then later on, they're using the filing cabinets as cannons out of the window. And like you said already, turning the building into a ship and a sailing on the wide accountancy. it's got some really good stuff in it, but yeah, it's not something that I want to revisit a lot. I think also because of the length of it, it just feels like you want the actual film to start in a way, because you have signed up for a Python film, and this feels quite like a little mini Terry Gilliam affair.
And I guess it's almost like that sort of, if you go to see a Pixar film and you've got the short at the beginning, although they are actually quite fairly shorter than this anyway. I mean, some of the scenes in here, I mean, I did laugh, admittedly, they form a Jolly Roger flag on a graph. And I mean, this came out in 83, and they've got a very good depiction of yuppies.
Yeah.
It's almost like going into an office from American Psycho.
Yeah, I think it's called something like the Very Big America Corporation or something like that. And there's a guy painting the signs of all the companies that they presumably own, I guess. And he carries on painting while they're all having this big swashbuckling sword fight around them. And then, yeah, the accountants basically win and take over, don't they? They stab someone else, like, hurls himself off the side of the building. And they take over the whole financial district, really.
Yeah, I suppose you could almost use that, you know, at any time with everything is the finance is king, they could just sail into the City of London and do something similar.
Yeah, but this this film won an award at Cannes at the time, as in the meaning of life as a whole, but apparently the Pythons said that they think it was very much because of this short film at the beginning, because it's very Cannes. I think they said the film snobs ate it up. it was more about this than about the rest of the film, which is more... I mean, it's mad. You've got this big sort of cinematic experience, and then it goes into the fish.
Yeah, and not before they've sailed off a flat earth.
Yeah, but, a very abrupt ending.
Yeah. And as you mentioned, the fish... they pop up every so often. You've basically got all the pythons superimposed onto goldfish. Just very silly. I wonder how many times I can say the word silly in a podcast. But it's goldfish saying morning, morning to each other.
Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Morning. Morning.
Very forgetful as goldfish tend to be, but yeah, the opening titles, again, it's very, again, sounds awful to call it standard Python fare, really, but you know, the very grand animation and the song, it's very befitting and very much in character with the rest of the movies and most of their work, to be honest.
Yeah, similar titles to Life of Brian with the sort of powerful song, although this time it's Eric Idle singing it with a really mad French accent. But I really like this song. It's got lots of energy. I felt like when I watched it the other day and this music started, I was like, yes, I remember this. And I love how they promise all of these things in the song, like, oh, is God really real? We're going to sort it all out now. And none of it gets sorted out. Like, all these big questions that they sort of tease, and none of it is going to get resolved in this film at all.
Yeah, I mean, I guess if you're going to go and watch this and hope for some answers, you're going to be entertained but disappointed.
Yeah, I think it kind of suits them that they, you know, they set up this profound premise, say we're going to do all these things, and then they just lead us down all these dead ends. You know, characters start conversations and they sound like they're going to be profound, and then they just aren't. I think it's sort of in keeping with Flying Circus, really, because they would often just abruptly end sketches. There weren't really any punchlines. I do think it is quite in keeping with what they've done before.
And this movie being, as we said, a collection of sketches in some sort of sequence, we open with part one, The Miracle of Birth. There's a lot of satire in this part around a lady being brought into a maternity ward in the hospital on the cusp of giving birth, and the doctors are more interested in looking good for the administrator, so making sure they've got all the machines and getting value for money. And the fact that the woman is essentially a customer and needs to be grateful, it's kind of almost a sight into what maybe they thought would have been a future health service.
Yeah, at one point she's sort of hidden behind some machines and they say, oh, bring it over here, and they're talking about her. You know, the patient is just secondary, really. They're more interested in the machine that goes ping. And of course the administrator does come in and they switch everything on. It's very exciting. And I love Michael Palin here, where they say to him, oh, we're doing a birth today. And he goes, ah, what sort of thing is that? Just no idea how hospitals work or how the human body works at all. It's just all about the budget.
And he gets one round of applause, and that's basically for a very convoluted system about leasing the ping machine.
Yeah, Betamax gets a little mention in this one. The berth's going to be available on Betamax.
Yeah, I mean, it's about time they get some credit. Yeah. VHS get too much, it's terrible.
So, it's lots of happy pills for you, and you can find out all about the berth when you get home. It's available on Betamax, VHS, and Super 8.
Yeah, I love how patronising they are towards the patient. I think she says, what do I do? And John Cleese just goes, nothing, dear, you're not qualified.
And when she says, is it a boy or girl? It's a little early to assign roles.
Yeah, I think my favourite bit might be when John Cleese is showing her the baby and he just sort of shakes it in her direction and then just shoves it in a cage somewhere.
And I'm sure they actually say rough towels.
Yeah.
And they sort of, I wouldn't say even wipe the baby down, they kind of, like they're washing a car.
Yeah, they'll just shove it somewhere. They've shaken it at the mother, that's enough.
Yeah, I think these doctors weren't hired for their bedside manner, let's put it that way.
Yeah, I think Terry Jones has said that it reminded him of his experience when his wife was giving birth, and I think the others have had similar experiences, and that's where it sort of came from, really. I mean, Graham Chapman is a qualified doctor at this point, so apparently he knew what all the machines were about.
As long as they go ping, that's the main thing.
Yeah, I think, doesn't he say at one point that the machine that goes ping, that means your baby's still alive?
And they use a cleaver to cut the umbilical cord. Everyone's allowed in except the husband.
Oh yeah, that's so silly, that bit. Only people involved are allowed in here.
I mean, strange. I mean, I go back to when my kids were born, and they were both by cesarean section in a room very much like that. And like, it sounds weird to compare it. I mean, bear in mind it was 83, so like, yeah, 35 years later or something like that. And the staff couldn't have been any nicer. And I don't remember there being a machine that went ping. So
how did you know if the baby was still alive, though?
Well, exactly. We just had to trust these people. And they obviously didn't have a good administrator involved. No one in a bow tie, anyway.
Yeah.
And I blame them for giving me scrubs that are about four sizes too small.
Oh, no. Yes. At least you weren't evicted from the room like the husband in this, though.
Yeah, I think there might have been if the scrubs had been any tighter. This sounds premature. We're going to go to part two, which is probably my favourite part of the film. And I mean, I've mentioned it before on the previous episode, probably the Fish Called Wonder one, where, you know, I quite unashamedly, I'd say Palin is my favourite of the Pythons.
Yeah, same.
And I think he gets a starring role in this part, which is the Third World, or Yorkshire. So it just reminded me of that's their gag, not mine. I think Yorkshire's lovely.
Yeah, when I was little, that joke completely went over my head because I had maybe I didn't know what Third World meant. But when I watched it the other day, I think it was me getting it for the first time. I was like, oh, they think the North is the Third World. I get it now.
And they open on something that looks like a Hovis advert, and it's all very as you'd expect.
Yeah, got this Catholic family who seem to have about 50 or more children. Michael Palin's the dad, and as he's coming towards the house, the stork is delivering another baby, and he's like, oh, bloody hell. And then we see Terry Jones as the wife, and the baby just drops out of it while she's doing some washing, and she goes, oh, get that, would you, Deirdre?
And again, it's Terry Jones dressed as a woman, which is daily business, really, isn't it?
Yeah.
I suppose he's got home, he's been made destitute, I think is his words. He's not got a job anymore, and having to sell all the children for scientific experiments. It's a bold claim. I didn't count quite how many kids there were, but I think one of the IMDb trivia things said there were, I think it may have been 65, 66 kids involved in the scene anyway, so not sure how many are on screen at any one time.
And I love how he says, I've got some news for the whole family. And then Terry Jones goes, oh, get the others in, Gordon. It wasn't all the children in that room. There's even more out the back who have to come in to hear the news.
And it's funny, as I mean, my wife watched the film, and how can I describe myself as a non-practicing Catholic, so it's not but again, she looked at me and just assumed that my whole family are like this, which they're not, because none of them live in Yorkshire. Yeah, we get the very memorable Every Sperm is Sacred song. I guess having that many children involved in a song and have it about sperm.
Yeah.
It's, and I know some of the kids have said again from reading up that they didn't know what the song was about.
Yeah, that makes sense. And I think in the sort of build up to it with the dialogue, he says, apparently at the time when they were shooting it, he said, little rubber thing on the end of my sock. And then they dubbed over it later. So they shielded that from the children. But then, yeah, singing the word sperm was fine.
I wonder if any of those kids went on to be strict Roman Catholics themselves living in the third world.
Every sperm is sacred. Every sperm is great. If the sperm is wasted, love is quite irate.
Let the heathen spill theirs on the dusty ground. God shall make
apparently, yeah, Terry Jones said apparently most of the budget went on this sequence, because as this song goes on and elaborates, it's quite a large dance number really in the back streets and people in outhouses and dancing on the cobble streets. It's it's like something out of this grand old style Hollywood affair.
Yeah, they got Arlene Phillips in to choreograph it, who had, I think she'd done Annie about a year before. So, yeah, that makes sense, because it starts off as this sort of little musical sort of song, and then it becomes a bit of a hymn. And then, yeah, at the end, it's this massive sort of musical extravaganza, and there's a guy on stilts, and there's a Chinese dragon going through the crowd. It's, yeah, I can see why a lot of money was spent on just that.
It's fantastic. And again, I, having watched the film last night and throughout the day, I had the soundtrack playing on Spotify for most of the day, and just obviously a lot of the songs were memorable. This one just tickled me a lot for some reason. It's definitely the funny one. And then the fact that after this, and I think that the soundtrack actually plays a lot of it just a straight lift from the film, they go straight into their Protestant neighbours living across the road, looking at them obviously in shock and horror with their two kids, and they're all very sensible.
Yeah, they're sort of superior because they can use protection. And even though the wife doesn't really seem to be aware of this, because she says, oh, well, we've had sexual intercourse twice and we've got two children, so it's the same for us, really. She's been living this sort of sheltered life. And I think Eric Idle's really good in this scene. He's all this sort of sexually repressed housewife, and oh yes, Harry, and sort of biting her lip when he's talking about, oh, I could do this to you, I could do that to you. Oh, it's so good. And meanwhile, in the background, all the kids are streaming out of the house, and it just keeps going and going for the whole scene. There, like, there must be hundreds of children.
I mean, if there's 66 or something involved, they must have gone round the block and come out again.
Yeah, I assume they're just walking around through some sort of, you know, revolving door. But yeah, it's just never ending.
And when they're talking about the different types of condoms that they can get from the popping down the road, he says, if I want to pop down, I can go and get some.
Yeah, French tickler.
And her face, and they're sort of noisy going, It's like a sort of, it was almost like having a Derek and Clive sketch going on.
I can wear French ticklers if I want.
You what?
French ticklers, black mambos, crocodile ribs, sheaths that are designed not only to protect, but also to enhance the stimulation of sexual congress.
Have you got one?
Have I got one? Well, no. But I can go down the road any time I want and walk into Harry's and hold my head up high and say in a loud, steady voice, Harry, I want you to sell me a condom. In fact, today I think I'll have a French tickler, for I am a Protestant.
Yeah, and I like how, you know, in Life of Brian, they got in a bit of trouble, you know, for mocking religion. And then in this film, they just sort of doubled down on it, really. They've got Protestants and Catholics all throughout the film, really. It seems to be quite a Python thing to sort of mock these British institutions like the church and the army and private school coming up in a bit.
I mean, part of the whole scandal, I suppose, about Life of Brian and was how it was perceived anyway to be sort of against the church. But obviously there was a lot of intelligent debate going on at the time, saying, well, not really. They're not mocking the church. They're mocking perhaps the people who take it a bit too seriously. And again, here, while they touch upon it, it's almost like they're pulling their punches a little bit in comparison. They're chucking a few words or phrases in almost as a kind of, yes, we're the same people still. But like you say, they take aim at a lot more things. And the school, the next scene, is just... I suppose it must be, and I didn't go to boarding school, but I think John Cleese said that this was almost exactly how his experience was.
Yeah, I think when I was younger, I think this assembly bit was one of my favourites. I think because of the language in it. Like, we start off with John Cleese doing this sort of nonsense Bible reading where he's saying things like, oh, there slew they the goats and placed they the bits in little pots. And then Michael Palin comes in as this chaplain doing his prayer, oh Lord, oh you are so big. I just love this bit. And then there's the rubbing linseed oil into the school cormorant and just ends the announcements by slipping in, apparently your mother died this morning.
Now that I can see that as a boarding school kind of thing. I mean, the school I went to certainly wasn't this bad. It was probably quite strict at times, but you can imagine that sort of very matter-of-fact thing as a group of boys being told there, and as long as they stick to the rules, then their mother died, they just have to man up and take it.
Yeah, just announced in front of the whole school. And then there's the little hymn at the end as well, begging God not to cook us in all these different ways.
A big vat of boiling fat, I think, was one of them.
Yeah, there's don't braise or bake or boil us or stir fry us in a wok.
The part you mentioned already about sort of praying to God being, oh God, absolutely huge.
We're all really impressed down here, I can tell you. And all the little boys repeating it back to him.
And now this cuts into, again, one of the bits I mentioned earlier that I definitely remember seeing from before was the sex education lesson. John Cleese being the strict schoolmaster and a selection of boys and the other pythons in school uniform sitting there, yeah, getting involved.
Yeah, apparently they just shot this in an actual school with the actual pupils, and that school had a black uniform, and the pythons decided that when they were wearing it, they looked just like adults. So then they had to make blue blazers for the entire school so they could look a little bit younger.
It was quite clever the way... I mean, I suppose if you're used to seeing Terry Jones mostly in elaborate women's clothes, then seeing him sort of dressed almost down in a boys' school uniform was a bit of a sight.
Yeah, I think I always used to skip past this bit when I was younger because I found it mortifying. I couldn't cope with this, especially I used to often watch it with my parents and stuff. I couldn't cope with this one, so I didn't have particularly strong memories of this sketch. But yeah, watching it now, it's really funny. I just couldn't handle it when I was about 14.
It's probably just as well this wasn't the standard lesson of the time.
I know. I love how it seems to be a sort of multiple lesson thing, like it's an actual subject at the school or something. Or did we do this last week? And the boys are just completely uninterested because even though they're talking about sex, it's in a classroom setting. So it's like they're just learning about photosynthesis or something. They just do not care. Looking out the window, having little toys confiscated, and John Cleese is kind of peak John Cleese here because he's this authority figure delivering all this stuff with a completely straight face. It's so good.
Their portrayal probably shows why there's whole generations of unfulfilled partners if this is the standard of a sex education they're giving. I mean, I'm not going to go into too much detail. I mean, let's be honest, we've never met, and some of the things that they talk about are probably quite weird to discuss. But but even things where they're talking about the foreplay, and he's saying, what's wrong with a kiss, boy? They're going to all these, you know, the boys seem almost quite forward-thinking in some of the things they're suggesting, and all he's saying for foreplay is a kiss.
Name two ways of getting them flowing, Watson.
Rubbing the clitoris, sir?
What's wrong with a kiss, boy? Hmm? Why not start her off with a nice kiss? You don't have to go leaping straight for the clitoris like a bull at a gate. Give her a kiss, boy.
Yeah, and they reveal this bed that sort of it pops out from behind the blackboard, doesn't it? Just out of nowhere. And then he invites his wife in to come and do a demonstration. They start undressing, and again, the boys just aren't paying attention. And he's like, this is for your benefit, as he's just like completely stripping off.
And this was another part that was like Fish Called Wanda, the way he undresses in some of his, I suppose, by modern standards, very dated clothes, but his kind of bloomer boxer shorts and prancing around. And the wife looks completely uninterested, which, to be honest, why would you be interested in that?
Yeah, and he says as well, like, oh, for the purposes of this, shall we skip the foreplay? And she's like, yeah, sure.
I say, who needs a copy of Cosmopolitan when you got John Cleese?
And the wife is Patricia Quinn from Rocky Horror, which I didn't realise until I went on IMDb the other day. Yeah,
I didn't realise that.
In Rocky Horror.
She looked a lot more interested in that.
Yeah.
There's a lot of the talk of, you know, while this is going on, and you can see Terry Jones is punished by for what he was doing by being sentenced to playing the Boys v Masters rugby match.
Yes.
It's quite a smooth transition from this scene of John Cleese mounting his wife into a rugby match where it's basically depicting a war which is about to come.
Yeah, the rugby match. It's such a simple idea, but I find it so funny every time these enormous men just tackling these like 10-year-old boys, and at one point there's clearly, you know, a dummy on the floor and they're just stamping on it and kicking it. It's so brutal. And meanwhile John Cleese is on the side sort of clapping and going, well played, which just makes it even funnier.
It's almost like a sort of guards v prisoners football match or something out of Mean Machine, but the way that it was just this relentless siege of enormous guys scoring tries against these boys, and at the end you see Terry Jones covered in mud looking like he'd seen a horrible scene, and then the smooth transition where he had where it actually cut to the war, and this is part three, and a very distinctive fighting each other.
Yeah, I think I like that transition with his face, and then there's some goalposts behind that sort of turn into two thin trees. And I think this sketch seems like it could have come out with Flying Circus, really, if it was a bit sort of, you know, cheaper with less explosions. It seems like that sort of thing. It's the soldiers have bought a load of gifts for their captain that they want to give him before he goes over the top. And for some reason, they've bought him two clocks and a watch. I'm not sure what the thinking was there. And they've got him a card with a load of blood on it. And he's not a fan. And then they, of course, get really offended that he doesn't want their massive gifts on the battlefield.
It's kind of, I mean, again, this is like working in an office where someone's leaving or having a big birthday. And I think one of the jokes they made, because they got them the small clock and then the big clock, and saying, oh, there was a miscommunication. They didn't know that we'd already bought the present.
Yeah, no coordination.
There's the scene as well where they're talking about making the cake. And do you know how difficult it is to melt butter at minus 15 degrees? There's love in that cake.
And they're all getting killed throughout the sketch as well. And it's basically just him left at the end. I think one of them's about to go off and get some little mats so they can eat the cake. And
yeah. It's
just him left, basically, with this pile of gifts that he doesn't need.
He's trying to set the table on top of a hill.
Yeah.
I mean, this is almost like Blackadder Goes Forth, but it's taken a slightly alternative turn.
Yeah, slightly more surreal Blackadder.
And again, this is a part of the, I won't say piss take, but the poking at the army, where we cut to the sergeant major in the parade square. And Michael Palin in very stiff uniform and the moustache screaming into the ears of his people. What would you rather do? And of course, all these various excuses come up, which manages to basically lose him the entire regiment.
Yeah, I like the way Eric Idle says, well, I'd rather be at home with the wife and kids. And he's like, would you now? But then he just lets them go anyway, and he sends all of them off to the pictures at the end, and it's just him marching up and down the square.
What would you rather be doing, Atkinson?
Well, to be quite honest, Sarge, I'd rather be at home with the wife and kids.
Would you now?
Yes, Sarge.
Right, off you go. Now, everybody else happy with my little plan?
He looked so lonely, but he was enjoying it.
Yeah, Michael Palin has a lot of range, I think. He's very, very angry here compared to usual.
I wonder how much cotton wool they must have put in the ears to protect from the shouting.
Yeah, and then after that, there's a little voiceover just saying, democracy and humanitarianism have always been trademarks of the British Army. And then you hear someone shout, rubbish!
And this is something I noticed throughout the film where a lot of the jokes or the funny lines were almost, I would say saved, but made better by, I don't even know if they're ad libs, but there was a part at the end of one of the scenes we'll come to later where it involved the Grim Reaper. And I think Michael Palin said something at the end, oh, I didn't do the salmon mousse. And just little things like that that chucked in that almost elevate them a little bit higher than what they are.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, definitely.
Now, from the parade square, we then go to the Zulu War of 1879 and another poke at the military where it shows the soldiers being, well, not massacred, but certainly involved in a very bloody fight. You're almost wondering where Michael Caine is. And then you see the officer class and John Cleese just trying to shave in a mirror. All this bloodshed is going around him. And again, I suppose this is where it's almost peak Cleese.
Yeah, he's sort of irritated when a spear goes through his mirror. Not that there's all this chaos going around. It's it's because he's annoyed because his shaving has been interrupted. And then he goes into the tent and Michael Palin is another officer in there just sort of filing his nails while all this madness is going on around them.
You sort of see the other officers grouped around and everyone's just kind of enjoying their jaunt to Africa. And he's there and you hear the screaming in the background and all the explosions, and you kind of think, like, this is, I don't know many, you know, former army soldiers or anything like that, but this is, you know, having met one person who went through Sandhurst to do all the officer school, you kind of imagine that he wouldn't have a clue of what to do if he'd been stuck in the trenches.
Yeah, there's a really bad story about this on the DVD commentary. Apparently most of the extras in the background are blacked up because they said they did hire a load of black extras initially, and apparently they weren't happy with the costumes for some reason, so they got rid of them and got a load of white extras in and blacked them up. How bad's that? Apparently a few of the guys towards the front are black, but then the ones in the background are not.
Oh, cue a load of people pausing this and going to YouTube and trying to find the bit.
It's not obvious. Yeah, I know, I didn't. It's on the DVD commentary. It's not in any of the kind of promotion.
Yeah, I suppose that's not something you're going to shout about, is it?
I know, it's mad. But this is, aside from, you know, not knowing that anyway, this isn't my favourite bit of the film. I feel like this is where it maybe lags a little bit and it feels quite like it isn't really going anywhere.
Yeah, because I mean this is the scene where it is a little bit dragged out, where Eric Idle has his leg bitten off.
Yeah, there are some really funny bits in it and really good performances. Like, I love how nonplussed he is about the fact that his whole leg has just disappeared in the night. They summon the doctor, and he says to him, oh, it's nothing to be worried about, and he's like, oh well, so it'll just grow back then, will it? I quite like all of that.
And, you know, they're more concerned about the size of the hole in this mosquito net.
Yeah.
I did like the line where they say, oh, have you been in the wars?
And then, Terry Jones runs in and he's a sort of lower-ranking soldier, so he's covered in blood. And Michael Palin is sort of recoiling away from him because he doesn't want to get blood on him. he says, oh, you know, there's a more pressing issue than what's going on outside. One of the officers has lost a leg. And Terry Jones says, oh, I'll organise a party right away. And John Cleese is like, well, it's hardly the time for that, is it, Sergeant?
And again, going off to look for the leg, and they find, this is a weird bit. And again, this is almost, you can tell maybe they noticed that because it hits the sequence that says it's the middle of the film.
Yeah.
When you've got Eric Idle and Palin dressed as the two ends of a tiger, trying to excuse the fact that they are in a field in Africa dressed as a fake tiger. It's all very strange. I mean, they say they're British intelligence at one point, and it's just very odd.
Yeah, they don't come up with an excuse, and then it's implied at the end that they are the ones who've actually taken the leg. And again, there's no real explanation for it, because then we go to the middle of the film.
Yeah, this is Michael Palin dressed as a woman this time, looking like she's doing a scene from one of the Barry Norman film shows of the time.
Yeah, they've said that they wanted initially to get a load of different celebrities to say, welcome to the middle of the film. I think the examples they gave were Sean Connery and Julie Andrews, but then they didn't have the money or the time for it. So instead, we just get Michael Palin dressed as a very sort of lovely, glamorous lady.
Well, she looks lovely.
So. I know, I think he looks good. Huh?
And this, the next part of the film is the bit that I just wrote odd.
Yeah, I feel like this bit is what people who haven't seen much Python think all of Python is like.
Yeah.
It often gets played as a clip, and I think it probably puts some people off because it is really bizarre.
I mean, it's the find the fish sequence, and it's just, well, again, trying to explain it for me is weird, and I saw an interview with Terry Gilliam saying that he regretted that it wasn't explained clearly enough.
What was there to explain, though?
I mean, you've got an elephant head in the background and Graham Chapman dressed almost like he's in the Rocky Horror Show.
Yeah, I've written down he looks like Lady Gaga. And he's got, like, taps instead of nipples. Ugh. And then a plug hanging from his crotch. Terry Jones has got these ridiculously long arms.
And they're just sort of strutting around a hallway in Battersea Power Station. Like you say, it's weird. And I guess to a beginner, if someone watched this and were told this is Monty Python, they just go, oh, okay.
No, thank you.
Yeah. And again, it's probably would work in a different context. But in this, you know, where we've already had the Zulu War to the middle of the film to this, and then what follows it afterwards as well is the part of middle age. And again, I think this is perhaps where maybe they couldn't think of a better sequence or segue from one section to another.
Yeah, and we get a little tiny bit with the fish in the middle as well, because they're it's quite meta. They're having a conversation about how, well, they haven't said much about the meaning of life so far, have they? And one of the fish says, oh, well, I expect they're building up to it.
Yeah, because the next sequence, part four, is two tourists going to a dungeon for dinner. It's
serving Hawaiian food.
And again, we'll come almost back to this scene later on, where it turns out that they're in heaven. And again, I guess maybe the dungeon for dinner, I mean, there are theme restaurants, I suppose. It could be one of the lower-end TGI Fridays.
Yeah, they're in a dungeon that serves Hawaiian food, and they get given a menu of conversations.
And John Cleese in a hairpiece that looks like Russ Abbott's, talking through this menu of starters, which I think the list are minorities, sports, and philosophy.
Yeah. And they go for philosophy but have no idea what it means. And I think this is the first time that the words, the meaning of life, are used within a sketch. And of course, the fish all sort of perk up at this and they're like, oh, wait, what was that? Because they think something interesting is about to happen. But of course, they've given this deep philosophical conversation to this sort of vapid but sweet American couple who don't really know what the word philosopher means.
And when they start just talking about which philosopher's names start with which letter, and you kind of think already, the fact that they've had to use the waiter as a kind of, oh, would you like me to start you off?
Yeah, and he asks them, oh, well, have you ever wondered why we're all here? And they're just like, nope.
I suppose that's probably I guess if you're a waiter in a restaurant, and you must be privy to a lot of these dinners where people will sit there and be struggling for things to talk about and go, oh, look at the decoration or something like that. But to sit there, and if you have no interest or experience in philosophy, to suddenly expect to talk about it, again, that the part is middle age. And I suppose if you're middle aged and if you've been married or in a relationship or live with someone for decades, then of course that there are certain things that I suppose there are times when you just run out of things to talk about.
Yeah, maybe a conversation menu is a good idea. I'm surprised some restaurant in America has probably done it, haven't they? They've got that's maybe in LA or something.
Yeah, I mean, it's almost like the sort of thing you'd have in a board game where the challenge is to talk about something you don't know about for 5 minutes.
Yeah, like a panel show, yeah. But yeah. They don't do very well with philosophy, though. They start talking about, oh, well, if philosophers have got the letter S in their names, then does that mean Selena Jones is a philosopher?
Yeah, it's probably a good thing they avoided the minorities conversation anyway.
Yep.
Now, the next part is part five. The very common live organ transplants.
Sorry, I started laughing then before you'd even said the name, because it just comes so out of nowhere. I think this might be my favourite section because it's just so random. You know, all the themes so far, we've had kind of, you know, middle age, growth and learning, and then out of nowhere, live organ transplants, as if that's a universal experience.
It's this scene is strange because I mean it essentially ends up with the song that we discussed at the beginning, but it starts off almost like a scene from Bottom with this just slapstick levels of violence, and all because, and as it's mentioned out, you filled out one of those silly cards.
Terry Gilliam is dressed as a sort of Jewish Rastafarian with dreadlocks and a little Hitler moustache. I mean, it's really bizarre. Graham Chapman and John Cleese knock on the door and they're demanding his liver because he's, yeah, bought one of those cards. And just, yeah, now how nonplussed the wife and son are while their, you know, husband and father is just being butchered in front of them. And they're not just removing the liver, they seem to be removing all of his organs completely. And at one point she says to them, oh, so you're not doctors? And they're like, oh, blimey, no.
And at one point his brother popped, oh, I'm just popping out now. And it kind of goes to show that, you know, Terry Jones almost just saying, well, you've got to take responsibility for your actions if you're going to sign a donor card. And, you know, people of a different generation from us now who'd be a lot younger. And I think they've changed the rules in the UK now where it's now an opt-out rather than an opt-in.
Yeah, yeah.
So perhaps those silly cards aren't such a thing. But even so, it's probably a scare story to those of you, people who are on the fence.
Yeah, because he tries to argue, oh, but it says in the event of death, and they're saying, well, you're not going to live through this, so. And then John Cleese seems to be sort of flirting with the wife, but what he's actually doing is trying to convince her to donate her liver as well, which then leads into this song to convince her somehow.
Yeah, Eric Idle steps out of a fridge in a pink suit and a wig. It's
of course.
It's magnificent.
I know. I love this song. It's so, it just seems really lovely. It's probably the most profound thing in the film, with some of the lyrics and everything, you know. I can't even remember any now. But the ending of it where it's kind of, you know, think about how insignificant your life is when you consider the universe. And Terry Jones just has this lovely look of wonderment on his face throughout the whole thing.
And the fact that this is about the meaning of life, and this is perhaps the only bit that has much relevant to science in it,
mm-hmm.
anything other than religion or organisation or culture or life, this is about actually how, if you are of that way of thinking, this is about how, you know, people are essentially made by molecules and where our place in the universe is. And I haven't seen this, but I believe they reworded the song a little while ago.
Yeah, I can't remember what it was for now, but I remember seeing it at the time and, you know, yeah, I respect them for updating it, but it does just sound weird when you're used to hearing the original version.
Yeah, I mean, didn't they get that Brian Cox fella to do it, the one who's always on the telly?
Yes, yeah. Was it for that thing Eric Idle did a year or two ago with Brian Cox? Maybe. That was weird.
Science changes and, you know, people's opinions and knowledge about a certain subject changes. But I suppose, does that mean we can go back and reword a lot of things? I mean, does that mean we can go back and recut Robocop? Oh, wait, they did remake Robocop, didn't they? I removed that from my brain. Because, I mean, some of the lines in Galaxy Song, where some of them I've written down, where it's, we're on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. It's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned. It sounds better when Eric Idle sings it.
Just remember that you're standing on a planet that's evolving and revolving at 900 miles an hour. That's orbiting at 90 miles a second, so it's reckoned a sun that is the source of all our power.
Again, it's just it works perfectly as a song, and I'll have to watch this new version again just to see, because I mean, there are probably other parts of the song. I'm no scientist, as my GCSE teachers will tell anyone, but why tinker? Why tinker?
Yeah, and I like it when they get back to the kitchen and John Cleese is just sort of waiting for them with the fridge door open, sort of pretending he's not there. And then Terry Jones's response is, oh, well, go on, then you've talked me into it. So it worked. The song did convince her to donate her liver while she's still alive.
She probably saw the bit with the animated woman getting pregnant that was made out of the sort of geometric shapes.
Yeah, and apparently there was supposed to be more animation in that song. But Terry Gilliam was too busy working on the Crimson Permanent Assurance, so he just didn't do it.
And of course that kind of ties into the next part of the film, where the Crimson... Oh, God, what was it? The
Crimson Permanent Assurance. Yeah, we see them invading... Well, we kind of see it from the other side, don't we? Because we start off in this meeting, and then they're having a discussion about the meaning of life, weirdly. Someone has looked into it for some reason. And they've boiled it down to two concepts. Number one, people are not wearing enough hats. And then the second is they go talk about matter and energy and souls. They say, oh, man's ability to be distracted from spiritual matters by everyday trivia. And then the kind of punchline is Terry Jones saying, well, what was that about hats again? And then we get the invasion.
Yeah, I mean, that's a fair point. I suppose people don't wear a lot of hats these days. Trying to watch Mad Men in the times of not doing this podcast, you see everyone's wearing hats and they all look very smart.
But, yeah, they weren't wearing enough hats in the early 80s, and it's even more so now, even more relevant.
Yeah, all these yuppies with their fancy haircuts. But again, it ties in weird, because one of the things we talked about when we watched the film was you didn't see any of the pythons in the short presentation of the Crimson Permanent Assurance. And of course, when they turn up this time, they're all in the office.
Yeah.
They go, oh, no, that's just the supporting production. You know, it's just the fact that it ties in so nicely. And yes, it's odd, but it works as a callback. And, you know, they don't overplay it enough. They don't replay the whole fight, thankfully.
Yeah.
The film would be about 4 hours long.
Yeah, and it ends in a kind of a different but similarly abrupt way, where a building just falls onto the ship building and just squishes it.
Part six, The Autumn Years, and this is perhaps probably the most famous scene of the film. A certain Mr. Creosote just put a picture of him on social media, and you get plenty of replies going, oh, I know him, I know him. It's Terry Jones at his most grotesque.
Yeah, it's strange that, because, yeah, my other half hasn't really seen much Python at all, but he knows this sketch. And it's quite weird to me, because I feel like it's quite sort of un-Python. I mean, because, I don't know, I think I just associate Python with these sort of very wordy sketches. And then this is completely sort of gross out humour. There isn't a huge amount of dialogue compared to probably every other sketch in the film. And, yeah, this is the one that seems to have taken off with people, really.
And, maybe that says a lot about the standard median of where people like their comedy.
Maybe, yeah, it's got more broad appeal than vomit being thrown everywhere.
Yeah, but then when you think about most of the lines come from the waiter, and the jokes come from there, and But essentially, people just love to watch a fat bloke vomit.
Yeah. With this sketch, Terry Jones and Michael Palin wrote it, and apparently people didn't really like it when they first did the sort of initial reading, so they just put this sketch on the reject pile. And then, I think they said a few months later, John Cleese sort of reassessed it and realised that the waiter was the funny character in it, really, and they sort of rewrote some of it, put in the whole wafer thin mint part of it, and then that's when it sort of became more of a funny sketch.
And that there were sort of sections in there, you know, the lady cleaning up vomit and the other diners vomiting, and there's a short joke or short line that isn't particularly elaborated on, where the woman on the neighbouring table, they have to make their excuses to leave, and this is where she says, oh, I have a heavy period. And again, that's not something that you'd, that's not really the sort of joke that you'd hear very often at the time. I mean, you know, sort of early to mid-80s. I mean, we don't get them now, and it's 2020. There's not a huge amount of comedy based around periods.
Yeah, and I did like that moment because it's Carol Cleveland, and she actually gets a funny line for once. So I'm pleased with that because she's in Flying Circus and is always playing the sort of sexy femme fatale. And she was never really given much funny stuff to do, and here I like the fact that she got a funny line for a change.
Just the fact that the husband's trying to play it off, oh no, we've got a train to catch, and
I don't want to start bleeding all over the seats. And I like how the waiter is kind of quite, he doesn't know what she's on about, whereas he's not really fazed by the vomit going everywhere. But as soon as a woman mentions having a period, he's like disgusted.
Everyone's got to be squeamish about something. Unfortunately, this was 1983, and you know, men have no concept of these things, apparently. So
yeah, it's so gross when he just opens up the menu and he immediately vomits into it, and John Cleese just sort of wipes it away with his hand. It's great.
I forgot to mention the introduction to the scene. I mean, this is in a very...
Oh, the little song, yeah.
The beautifully grand dining room restaurant, and Eric Idle singing. I mean, it's called the Not Noel Coward song.
Okay.
But, and it's basically just, it's almost like he's reading a section out of the Viz Profanosaurus of just slang for a penis.
Yeah, I knew this off by heart when I was about 14, and I don't think I fully grasped the extent of it, but yeah, I just know it in my head now, but I still think it's really funny. It's good little intro to the scene.
You didn't go around singing that at school, did you?
Oh god, probably. I don't know, not to the teachers, maybe to some friends, and they were probably like, what's Monty Python?
And one bit after the waff of thin mint, and I mean, Mr. Creosote's reaction of fuck off on full. Again, that's something like that is, I mean, it's almost universal. You can just picture that on after a heavy Sunday roast or after a Christmas dinner, and everyone's sitting there in their novelty jumpers, fuck off.
Yeah, and I'll have the lot as well. It's quite a quotable line.
And the fact that John Cleese has to feed the wafer thin mint in with a pair of very flash tweezers.
Finally, monsieur, a wafer thin mint.
Bah.
Oh, sir, it's only a tiny little thin one.
Now fuck off, I'm full.
Oh, sir. It's only a wafer thin.
Well, I couldn't eat another thing. I'm absolutely stuffed. Bugger horse.
Just one.
Just one.
Just the one.
Yeah, and I like the way he just sort of, he does that and then he runs away and just dives into a plant because he knows what's going to happen. He looks really delighted about it.
I suppose it's like the scene in Willy Wonka where, is it Violet eats the gobstopper and inflates, except at least she stops, unlike our friend here.
Yeah, there's a little deleted scene where it's just a few seconds and it's him walking to the restaurant and he's got his stomach on a little sort of wheelie thing in front of him. I thought that was quite cool.
God, I mean, that suit was enormous. And the fact that even after he's exploded and the vomit's gone everywhere and he's still there and there's just this carcass hanging off. It must have been an odd one, I suppose, watching that for the first time. Apparently this was something that even freaked out Quentin Tarantino. So.
Oh yeah, I saw that. They went too far, clearly.
Yeah, all the things he's done and seen, and this is the thing that did it.
Yeah, it was vegetable soup, and apparently there was a wedding in that venue the next day, so they had to just sort of scrub it down immediately, all this vegetable soup everywhere.
God, open a window. So, part 6B, it's essentially the morning after. This is probably cleaning up for that wedding. They're mopping up after Mr. Creosote. And then we have one of those lines that you kind of just think now. I think the cleaner says, oh, at least I don't work for the Jews.
Yeah, and he tips a bucket over her head.
It's almost like, right, challenge that. We don't hire racists. And then one weird bit, and I was trying to picture where in London this was filmed. It looks like it's somewhere sort of Kensington or around the West Brompton way. But Eric Idle, who's the waiter, goes out into the street and he's being followed. Go, no, no, just a little further, as he's kind of breaking the fourth wall. And all of a sudden, we just get led to this cottage where he just suddenly gets very angry and tells us his life story.
Yeah, because this section's called The Meaning of Life for some reason. So we think, oh, maybe we're in for something here. The fish are probably getting excited. And yeah, he leads us on this long walk, tells us all these sort of pearls of wisdom that his mother told him, and then just gets really irrationally furious with us for some reason. And he's like, okay, well, if you don't like that, then fuck off.
It's just very odd. I mean, he walks and he seems so nice and coy and very happy to talk and all that. Oh, fuck you.
I can live my own life in my own way if I want to.
And he looks so smart as he stomps off to the little cottage in the middle of nowhere.
Yeah, that's a really weird little section. Just, again, as if they're going to sort of reveal something and then cut it short with just an outburst.
And now the final part, part 7. It opens with if you're being allowed to choose your own execution. And we've got Graham Chapman being chased by, I don't know, a dozen or so topless women in slow motion, like something out of Baywatch.
Yeah, when they were coming up with ideas for this film, apparently one of the ideas they were sort of floating around was the Pythons being sort of on trial for not making a proper film, which sounds very meta, and then at the end they were going to be found guilty and executed. And then this apparently was an idea that came from that, the whole, oh, they all get to choose how they get executed. This idea sort of made it over from that draft, really. And yeah, Graham Chapman's being pursued by these women, and they say that his crime was making gratuitous sexist jokes in a moving picture.
As I suppose part of that idea carried over anyway. And of course, the weird thing is that that's actually how he, you know, it shows how he died. There wasn't anything sort of elaborate or sexual around the way he died. They just literally chased him off the end of a cliff and he landed in his own grave.
Yeah.
Yeah.
It's like a bit like a Midsommar.
Yeah. I mean, after all that hassle, it just ends up like that. It's, you think you don't get any pleasure at the end of it. I suppose you do have to die, I guess, so.
Yeah.
Yes. And yeah, this is while they're already giving the sermon for his funeral before he's even in there.
Yeah.
And he just lands perfectly on time.
Yeah, they're all waiting for him. And he genuinely looks terrified as well. He's not getting any pleasure out of it.
Yeah, I suppose. Yeah, it's weird. I don't know. Again, mid-80s. But the girls were dressed in, you know, they looked like they'd come from a roller skating party or something. But. Very neon colours and headgear.
What a strange job to get.
Yeah, I do wonder. I mean, you know, there were huge names on the credits at the end, you know, those who were in that scene and those who were in the short presentation and the dance sequence at the end. I mean, there's a lot of people. I wonder if any of them went on to do anything of some repute, and this was kind of their first introduction to the movies.
Well, yeah, there's one in the Christmas dance later that I'll mention later. Have you heard this?
No, I don't.
Okay, I'll tell you later then.
Okay, well, that to look forward to. Let me make a note. So the next the part is the Grim Reaper banging on the door, and I guess this is kind of almost like an Abigail's Party kind of dinner thing going on, where he bangs on the door and Eric Idle opens. Is it about the hedge as he turns up with his scythe? And being invited in, and everyone's very, very polite, I suppose you would be if a stranger turns up to your dinner party.
Yeah, and they're all just completely unaware of what the Grim Reaper is for some reason. I remember I always used to switch the film off before this bit, not because I didn't like it, but because I found it a bit sort of scary and bleak. And I'm not sure why. I think it's the fact that they all just are dead. I'm not sure. Something about that quite disturbed me when I was younger, and I used to end the film at this point. But watching it now, yeah, it's really funny. I love Graham Chapman as this sort of ultra polite Englishman. Like, oh, it's a Mr. Death or something. He's come about the reaping. I don't think we need any at the moment. Bless him. And there's some good Python women in this bit. There's Terry Jones as this sort of sozzled woman. Michael Palin's this very sort of smug American who's asking questions like, Mr. Death, is there an afterlife? And then makes a really smug face, like he's very pleased with himself.
And as, you know, a good host, he's offered wine, beer, sherry. And we're sitting there wondering what the ultimate aim of this, who has he come to take? And it turns out that it was all of them because of the salmon mousse that killed them all.
And Eric Idle says, I'm most dreadfully embarrassed.
And the whole time as they turn into ghosts and they're being led out, it wasn't fresh salmon.
Yeah, it was canned salmon, and it killed them all immediately.
And this is the thing I mentioned earlier where Michael Palin said, I didn't eat the salmon mousse.
Yeah, a little improvised line at the end.
And then the fact they all get into their cars just to go with him, and then the cars turn into ghosts as well.
Yeah, and they arrive at heaven where it's Christmas every day, which doesn't really sound that heavenly to me.
Yeah, that'd be one of those things where that could kill me now sort of thing. It's the same sort of entrance to where the couple went earlier, the middle age, where they went to the dungeon restaurant, because we actually see them very briefly.
Yeah, I suppose it's a little bit of a twist, isn't it? Like, oh, they were dead, and we've already seen heaven, but we didn't realise it.
Equating middle age to death says a lot. Midlife crisis. And they're taken into a banquet hall where pretty much the whole cast of the film are in there. You've got the topless girls, the kids from the Third World sketch.
Well, that's
soldiers.
So upsetting that the kids are there. I feel so bad for the kids being sold off for medical experiments.
Yeah, those experiments obviously didn't go very well.
No.
And yeah, so they're all sitting there waiting for the big musical number. Graham Chapman as God.
With very, very white teeth and a very cheesy accent.
Yeah, he looks like the guy from Grease singing Beauty School Dropout.
Yeah, he does.
He's singing Christmas in Heaven, and there's a few sort of visual gags in there, and you've got all these dancers with outfits that look like they're topless.
It's Christmas in Heaven, there's great films on TV. The sound of music twice an hour, and Jaws 1, 2, and 3.
Oh, so one of the dancers in this is Jane Leaves, who is Daphne in Frasier.
Ah, okay.
Yeah,
would that have been her first role?
I'm not sure. She used to be a dancer, and I think that was mainly what she did. And then obviously she went into acting at some point. But yeah, she's in this. In the DVD extras, there's like a little interview with her talking about it.
Oh, wow. Okay. So someone did make it big out of this thing.
Yeah, I haven't been able to actually spot her when I've been looking, but they all do look quite similar. You know, they've all got the same sort of wigs and stuff on.
Oh, fantastic. Yeah, you learn something new every day. I mean, this number is very grand, like proper old Hollywood again. But yeah, very, very grand affair and this organised dancing. And I guess this would have been the Arlene Phillips might have been involved in this as well.
She was, yeah. Yes, it sort of seems like it should be the ending of the film because, yeah, it's very, you know, sort of a musical extravaganza, and then we get the actual end of the film where we go back to the middle of the film lady being given an envelope.
Yeah, she just looks so fed up.
She just wants it to be over, yeah. She gets given an envelope, and thank you, Brigitte, which has the meaning of life written on it.
Well, that's the end of the film. Now here's the meaning of life. Thank you, Brigitte. Well, it's nothing very special. But try and be nice to people, avoid eating fat, read a good book every now and then, get some walking in, and try and live together in peace and harmony with people of all creeds and nations.
It ties up nicely. While it doesn't have the narrative throughout of say Life of Brian or the Holy Grail, and even the Holy Grail finished quite abruptly because I believe they ran out of money. At least it has an end, which I suppose that maybe that was the joke, the end of the film. It tied up quite nicely at the end. I mean, you got a nice number, and I believe there was, again, this is an IMDb thing, that Graham Chapman wanted to play the role of God because he was upset around the fact that he couldn't marry his partner at the time because he was gay.
Oh, okay.
And that was something that he specifically asked to do, so it certainly worked pretty well anyway.
Yeah, apparently this film was banned in Ireland, as was Life of Brian, and Terry Jones's next film, was it Personal Services or something? That was banned in Ireland as well, so it was like a hat trick for him, because of the whole, you know, the religious stuff and the sexual stuff. Ireland weren't on board.
No, Ireland's probably still not. I'll get told off for that, but then I'll half Irish, I'll be okay. Yeah, because I mean, Personal Services, I haven't seen it for a very long time, and it was on, I recorded it off the telly quite recently. I need to watch. And I mean, that was basically around a brothel.
Okay, I haven't seen it.
I believe it was. Yeah, Julie Walters play. I'm not sure what the circumstance is, but she ends up running a brothel.
Oh, that sounds good.
It was on that Talking Pictures channel quite recently, I believe. Okay. And I recorded it with the intention of, basically my skybox is full of 80s movies that I've been meaning to, or that I think one day I might do an episode about. But I didn't realise until he died, what was that, about 2 months ago, that Terry Jones had directed that.
Mm-hmm.
And again, one of the other episodes you did about Eric the Viking, Terry Jones directed that, and that was certainly a lot more Python. I suppose we could have said that about the whole film. But very enjoyable nonetheless.
Yeah, I think it is maybe the darkest thing they ever did. It is very much about death and the pointlessness of life, really, like the futility of it all. People keep dying throughout the film in really pointless ways. Like, there's a whole section about war, eating the salmon mousse, having your organs taken from you while you're still alive. Yeah, it does go to some quite dark places. And yeah, I think when I was little, I did think it was a little bit disturbing. I enjoyed it, but there was always that sort of dark edge to it. And yeah, watching it now, I can see why it is quite adult, you know, and it is a bit more gory as well.
I do wonder where, if they had toyed with doing a narrative version of this, how that might have worked. I think the idea of the sketches, and I guess unless you'd had one, you're following one character's journey through life, I can't really see where that might have worked. But
Eric Idle suggested that in one of the DVD extras. He said something about, oh, maybe it would have been better if we'd followed one man's journey through life. But then, yeah, some of the sketches are set in completely different time periods, so I'm not really sure how that would have worked. We would have had to change some of the sketches quite a lot.
Oh, right, so I'm on the same page as Eric Idle.
Yeah, it is a shame, though, that some of them are looking back at it and thinking it wasn't that good, because I think it is really good. It's got some really funny moments. There aren't really any sketches where I think, oh, this is really bad. You know, they sort of range from brilliant to pretty good, I would say.
Yeah, and I like a lot of it. I mean, the musical numbers add a huge amount. I mean, the soundtrack to this, yes, a lot of it are, you know, direct lifts from the film, but I mean, some of the songs are just fantastic. Mm-hmm. And, you know, even if you don't have a copy of the film, I mean, you can dig it out. I mean, it's probably all on YouTube or somewhere for free. But, yeah, I mean, it's just, you know, we probably haven't done enough justice to some of them. But I'll always go back to the Every Sperm is Sacred song.
Yeah, I think if anyone's listening is kind of thinking of it as a less good Python film and maybe hasn't watched it in a while, I would still recommend watching it because you might sort of rethink it.
Even if you don't find it as, I mean, even if you love Life of Brian, you'll still enjoy this massively. I think maybe, you know, again, it just suffers from its more glamorous, attractive, memorable relatives.
Mm-hmm.
But, yes, I suppose it could be the same about some people. Moving on. So that's the meaning of life done. Sophie, why don't you tell us a little bit about where we can find your podcast?
So I have a podcast called Smashed Prawns in a Milky Basket. If that doesn't mean anything to you, it's probably not for you. It's a podcast about the work of Julia Davis, who's a comedy writer, director, actor, etc. And basically on each episode, I have a different guest on and we talk about a different show that was created by Julia Davis. So Nighty Night, Hunderby, Human Remains, lots of different things. And on Twitter, it's at Julia Davis QOTD, because it's also a sort of quotes Twitter account.
Okay. Have you done an episode about camping?
That is the one that I've not done just yet. I was going to be doing it now, but obviously we're in lockdown, so I'm not sure what the plans are.
Okay. I'll be honest, that was the one I've seen most recently, and that was very enjoyable. So,
yes, I love camping. I haven't deliberately left it till last. It's just kind of worked out that way with guests and everything.
Yeah, tell me about it. So. But yeah, no, I'll put plenty of links to those on the show notes for the episode, because it's essential that people find these out. And I mean, and is there, for those people, like you said, who may not appreciate the name gag, would there be an episode that you'd recommend to get into, maybe as a starter?
I'm not sure. Most people seem to have seen Nighty Night compared to a lot of her other stuff. And it's actually all on BBC iPlayer at the moment. So if you're, you know, a bit bored, maybe during lockdown, I would recommend watching Nighty Night on iPlayer and then maybe listen to that episode of the podcast.
Lovely. Well, who knows what state this world will be in by the time this episode comes out. Obviously, we're dating it massively. It's recording in April 2020 when people aren't allowed out the house, and weirdly the TV companies are letting us watch quite a lot of stuff for free, so enjoy it while you can. But if you get a chance to watch Nighty Night, yeah, it's on iPlayer, and we'll put the links to Sophie's podcast on the show notes. Now, Sophie, thank you very much for bringing your Betamax copy. We best rewind it so that they can make another mention of Betamax in the film. Now, as we discussed off air, the number one song in the UK when this film came out, it was Baby Jane by Rod Stewart, and that was on the 7th of July 1983. Now, I've already used that song to close a podcast, which I believe was the Flashdance episode, because Flashdance came out the week before. What a 1983 was a golden age of cinema.
A wild time.
Yeah, with Flashdance, The Meaning of Life. I think I recently did a couple around Never Say Never Again and Superman 3, but what a weird time. So what I'll do is I'll play out the podcast with the song we mentioned earlier, the Not Noel Coward song, the song that Sophie used to go around singing an awful lot and knows all the words to. Anyway, Sophie, thank you very much.
Good evening, ladies
Thanks
and gentlemen.
For having me.
Here's a little number tossed off recently in the Caribbean. Isn't it awfully nice to have a penis? Isn't it frightfully good to have a dong? It's swell to have a stiffy, it's divine to own a dick. From the tiniest little tadger to the world's biggest prick. So three cheers for your Willy or John Thomas. Hooray for your one-eyed trouser snake. Your piece of pork, your wife's best friend, your Percy or your cock. You can wrap it up in ribbons, you can slip it in your sock. But don't take it out in public or they will stick you in the dock. And you won't come a back. Oh, thank you very much.
Oh, what a frightfully witty song.
This podcast was brought to you by executive producers Gary West, Fergus Higginson, Keith Foster, Jimmy Fletcher, Mark Drakes, Matt Cunnington, Christian Dees, Andy Elliott, Chris Hopkins, Omar Zambon, Ian Madrell, Katrin Lowe, Mark Makin, Zoltan Vargo, Simon Smith, Matt Lee, Laurie Curran, Wayne McNally, Darren Hodgkins and Dan Wellington, associate producer Chris Oakley. Visit patreon.com/Betamax Video Club for more information about bonus episodes, early access and more.